talking about the various men and women of the early Adventist church. Have you noticed they're not the same? Have you noticed that the preachers who speak from this pulpit are not the same? If you were here last night, you certainly knew that Ron Halverson is a different presenter than I, and the Lord blessed him in a powerful way last night, and blessed all of us as we shared together. It's a reminder to us once again that God can use a great variety of people in His cause, and He can use a great variety of us to do the work that needs to be done. I think of the parable of the talents. In Matthew, the 25th chapter, we won't take time to read it today. It's familiar to you. But as you read about this parable of the talents in Matthew 25, you discover that those people of the talents were different. There was one who had five, there was one who had two, and one who had one. Now, the person with one talent was not questioned as to his ability because he only had one, but rather that he did not use the one he had. I was talking in one of our seminars yesterday or day before, I've forgotten which, perhaps day before. Some of you have been there, and I appreciate the many who have joined us in our seminars in the afternoon, about the experience of a man who came to one of our general conference sessions, a man by the name of Captain Norman, or at least he claimed to be a captain. And as he heard about the needs of the world church, he apparently was impressed that he should give of his money. Ellen White, at the time, it was 1899 General Conference in Lancaster. Ellen White was in Australia at the time. There was urgent need for money, and for there as well as other places in the world. And they called for pledges at this particular camp meeting at South Lancaster. And as the various ones pledged, some perhaps $50, some $100, Captain Norman got up and said, "I'll give $5,000." And pretty soon another need came, and "I'll give another several thousand." And before that session was over, Captain Norman had committed $400,000 to the church. But very strange thing happened. As this man of apparent wealth began pledging these huge numbers, Ellen White talked about it a little bit later because, well, I don't want to get ahead of the story, but just to say that what happened was that with this man pledging great amounts of money, the pledging of the small amounts dwindled and finally died. Well, the story, of course, developed that this man became interested in one of the young ladies, secretaries there, and over the period of the many days they were together, it developed into a friendship, and just before the session was over, he told the folks that he needed to go somewhere and tie up his business affairs on something, and he would be back. He turned to this young lady and he said, "Now, I seem to be short of cash." Sound familiar? "I wonder if you might loan me $300. And so this young lady, unsuspecting of any problem, gave him $300 and he was never seen again. He disappeared. A con artist or whatever. And Ellen White talked about this experience, and I think of that particular experience. She said to the folks that were there and to others, "We ought not to depend on the great wealth of certain people, because this taught us a lesson that each of us need to participate, no matter what we have. That's true of talents as well as money. It was a strong object lesson to the church at that time, and I hope we can still remember the lesson from it today. God expects us all to do what we can with what we have. What do you say? And there's room for the small gifts as well as the large. Because after all, the blessing comes to the giver, whatever that is. Well, I didn't mean to get sidetracked there, but I thought about the great variety of talents, and it reminded me of this experience. If we were to look at the early Advent pioneers of this church, I think we would have to say that there were some of them that had five talents, and I would suggest two of such are the ones I want to talk about today, Annie and Uriah Smith. If there were any in that group that had five talents, it was these two, brother and sister. Without question, there were many of those early Adventists that had tremendous talent. James White certainly did. Ellen White was certainly a gifted person, more than just the gift of prophecy, and we could go on. But Uriah Smith and Annie Smith seemed to be especially talented, naturally. Most of these early pioneers had very little formal education. It's interesting that of the group that began this church, probably Annie and Uriah had the most. They did go on beyond elementary school. And referring to Annie and Uriah Smith, one historian has said this, Spalding, writing about them, "No better examples are there of New Hampshire granite, not only in the beautiful character that results from its polishing, but in the indomitable grit that comes from its grinding." Annie Smith was 4 years older than her brother Uriah. She was born in 1828. With her brother and parents, she joined the Millerite Advent movement and went through the disappointment of 1844. She was 16 years old at the time of the disappointment, just 4 months younger than Ellen Harmon, later to be Ellen White. They were both 16, looking for the second coming of Christ, teenagers. Following the disappointment, Annie turned her attention back to school. Somehow drifted a little way from the Advent movement. She wanted to get an education, and co-education was not common in those days, so she attended a woman's seminary at Charlestown, Massachusetts in her early 20s, and there trained to be a teacher. Annie was a poet. Her mother was a poet. Uriah Smith was a poet. Annie and her brother had a common interest in art as well as poetry. We have some evidence of her skills as a painter. Both Annie and Uriah Smith wrote hymns, though she was even more prolific than her brother Uriah. In 1852, after several years after the disappointment, Joseph Bates was to hold some meetings near where Annie lived, and her mother, Rebecca Smith, had remained an Adventist. And Joseph Bates visited with her, and he said, "I'm going to hold meetings in this particular place, and I would like to encourage you to ask Annie to join in the meetings. Come and listen." Well, her mother told her of the meetings, and Annie decided to go to the meeting just to please her mother. She wasn't as involved with the Advent movement as a young lady now. Some of you know that the night before, she had a dream. And Joseph Bates also had a dream, and they were similar. She dreamed the night before that as Bates began his sermon, she arrived late and took the last seat in the meeting place. In her dream, she also heard the words he would speak. He was talking about Daniel 8:14, and she saw a prophetic chart hanging. No doubt very similar to the one you see in facsimile back at the back of this room. That same night, as I said, Bates had a similar dream in which he saw Annie coming in late and taking the last seat. The next evening, Annie left in plenty of time for the meeting. She lost her way. By the time she got there, she was late. The second hymn was being sung, and when she entered the door, trying to find a seat, to her amazement, perhaps, she saw there was only one seat left and took it. And listened to Bates as he talked about Daniel 8:14, unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. He was the man she'd seen in her dream. And these were the very words she'd heard spoken in her dream. And the chart was the one she had seen. Now, one of the unusual things about this story is that Joseph Bates had planned to speak on a different topic that night, and he changed his topic after he stood to his feet. Each remembered their dreams, and afterwards they spoke with each other and felt that the Lord had led in this particular situation. You see, not only did the prophet receive dreams, but some of the other early pioneers received dreams that the Lord sent. I've often looked at this particular thing, and I think that perhaps I would understand, that the dreams that came to these others generally were for themselves. They didn't consider themselves prophets. But they also considered that God was interested enough in them to send them dreams. He did to James White, he did to Bates on different occasions, and of course, in this particular situation, to Annie. After that meeting and the opportunity to become acquainted with Bates, Annie went back to the school that she was attending, not to go to school, but to close up her plans there, and accept the Sabbath and the Advent message once again. Renew her confidence in the fact that she believed Christ was coming. Because of her interest in poetry, and of course we're now in the year 1852, the publishing work of the church had now moved to Rochester, New York, and Annie submitted a couple of her poems to James White. And they were printed in that early time in the Advent Review. And after the printing of these two poems, and James White recognized her skills and her abilities and talents, invited her to join the publishing work there at Rochester. And so, late in the year, December, in 1852, Annie joined James and Ellen White and the others there at Rochester at the age of 24. 6 months later, her brother Uriah would also come to Rochester the day after his 21st birthday. He was about 4 years younger than she. Some of us, of course, are aware of the fact that Annie and Uriah Smith both had some skills and training, and both of them had opportunities, and in fact, a rather lucrative offer to teach when they first joined this movement at Rochester. They'd been offered $1,000 each for a year's teaching contract with room and board in addition. Now, that doesn't sound like much today, but that was a very good wage, $1,000 a year and room and board in addition. But instead, both Uriah Smith and Annie, his sister, turned their attention to Rochester and the publishing of the Advent Message. And they went there not for salary, but only for room and board. That's all they were given. Annie became assistant to the editor very soon. She served as a proofreader and did other technical work in connection with the publishing. For the next 2 years, her poems appeared regularly in the review. And several of them are set to hymns and were sung by early Adventists. We have some of them in our hymnals today. Also, we have one from Uriah Smith in our hymnal. In November of 1854, Annie had to leave Rochester because of illness. She had contracted tuberculosis. They called it consumption in those days. She'd been working on a book of poems to be published. Been working on this for several months. Annie felt that when her book of poems was done, Perhaps her work would be done. She wasn't sure because she was very ill. Her brother, Uriah, sketched and engraved a beautiful little flower. Her favorite flower was the peony, and so he did a woodcut of a peony and arranged this to be put on the front of her book of poetry. 10 days after Uriah took the final manuscript for this book of poems to the office for printing, Annie died. She was 27. The book of poems is somewhat unusual in that one section contains poems that had been written by her, dedicated to several early friends who had died in their early life. The book of poems entitled Home Here and Home in Heaven includes poems that Annie Smith wrote, remembering, in one case, the brother of Ellen White, Robert Harmon. He died at the age of 27, and so there's a poem dedicated in her book to Robert Harmon. James White's sister, Anna, died while she was working there at Rochester, and there's a poem in there written to and about Anna White, James White's sister, who died at the age of 26. There's also a poem written in honor of James White's brother, Nathaniel, who died at age 22, also working at Rochester. There's another poem at the death of Lyman Maston, who was helping them in the publishing there. He died at the age of 25. What tough times. All of these young people dying in their 20s. But in each case, Annie Smith wrote a poem commemorating their death. In 1852, as the publishing work was first established in Rochester, those who came to work with James and Ellen White were very young. Whenever I look at the copies of the papers that were printed between 1852 and 1855, when the publishing was at Rochester, I'm reminded of the youth of those who worked in the beginnings of our publishing. James White was the oldest. He was 31. Ellen White was 25 when they set up publishing there. Anna White, 26. Nathaniel, 22. The foreman of the press, Lumen Maston, 23 when they began. Fletcher Byington, who worked there, was 20. Annie Smith, 24. Uriah Smith, 21. George Amidon, 17. And the boy who swept up after the day's work was 13-year-old Warren Batchelor. And that was the group that published our papers. This church was not begun by the old. It was begun by the young. Aren't you glad for that? The Lord can still use young people today, my friends. And those of you who may be here who are young, remember that God began this work with youth. In writing about Annie Smith, Elder Spalding said this, "A sweeter, more self-effacing, yet talented woman has never been among us, nor, we may say, elsewhere than Annie Rebecca Smith." The hymns that can be found in our hymnal today, written by Annie Smith, are How Far From Home, I Saw One Weary, and Long Upon the Mountains. Annie is buried in a small community cemetery at West Wilton. This was where she and her brother Uriah grew up. Her grave is marked with a very simple granite stone that lays flat with the ground. We discovered it a few years ago. We did not know for sure where she was buried, but we found the burial plot, and as we looked more closely, here was a flat stone, and on the top of it, it just says Annie. We know it to be Annie Smith. Her obituary in the review was placed there by her brother Uriah, and here's what he said in this brief obituary. Died in Wilton, New Hampshire, July 26, 1855, of consumption, my sister, Annie R. Smith, aged 27 years. The following lines, which she composed the day but one before her death, show with what feelings and hope she fell asleep in Jesus to wait the glad morning of the resurrection. And here is the bit of poetry that appeared with that record of her death by her brother. She wrote these words the day before, "O shed not a tear o'er the spot where I sleep. For the living and not for the dead ye may weep. Why mourn for the weary who sweetly repose, free in the grave from life's burden of woes? I long now to rest in the lone, quiet tomb, for the footsteps of Jesus have lightened its gloom. I die in the hope of soon meeting again the friends that I love, and with Him ever to reign." Annie Smith lived a short life, but a life that was committed completely to the Lord. The sister of Uriah Smith. We could say much more about Annie, but the life was so brief that we perhaps have told you the highlights of that experience. Uriah Smith, her brother, by contrast, lived a quite different experience. At the age of 4, he was given a dose of poisonous calomel to treat an illness, and the treatment was not successful, caused an ulcer on his left leg that left him more or less crippled for several years. Finally, at the age of 12, with his mother holding his hand, a doctor placed him on the kitchen table in their home with no anesthetic and cut off his left leg. He talks about this. And by the way, it's a very interesting letter. I think it tells something about Uriah Smith. It's a very brief letter that he wrote to a friend or someone who asked about healing. Let me share just a little bit of this letter. The person had asked about why we needed medicine and why we needed doctors and so forth and medical practice. And here's what it said. "I think I understand your question, which I took to be, is why not more healing or healing accomplished by faith and all medical practices and medicines discarded? As I said, I believe the promises, and when the conditions are complied with, what is promised will be done. But one of the conditions is that it shall be the will of God to do the work, that is, if it will be for the best and for His glory. But this we do not know, unless God sees fit to specially reveal it to us. So then, if the work is not done, the only conclusion we can come to is that the conditions are not met. What then? Shall we give up? No, have faith and wait on till God gives us power to meet them so far as it belongs to us to meet them. But surgical operations are sometimes necessary." And then he tells about his experience. "For instance, I had a fever sore in my leg when 4 years of age, and at 12 I found myself with a shriveled, drawn-up leg and stiff knee and the sore breaking out again. It was evident to anyone that the leg must be taken off or I lose my life. Now, I know of nothing by which a leg can be taken off without a knife. So a knife was used, and I've had no trouble since, except the trouble of wearing an artificial limb. We must take a rational view of all these matters." That's an interesting statement from Uriah, isn't it? He saw that we could pray for healing, and no doubt that had taken place in his experience. And when healing didn't come, he saw that the Lord saw fit not to heal him, and so a surgical operation was done, and his leg was cut off on the kitchen table. By the way, this particular operation took place just about the time of the disappointment, 1844. Afterwards, his family had drifted away from the Advent believers, except his mother, apparently she stayed, and of course, Uriah Smith began to come back in his early 20s, actually about 20. He first heard James White preach, and finally at the age of 21, he came back to the church and joined the group at Rochester on the day after his 21st birthday in early 1853 in January. Now, Uriah Smith, I think, had an interesting sense of humor. Different things indicate to this, and we'll note them in just a moment. But when they came together to be at the publishing work at Rochester, he and his sister had given up a very lucrative job at $1,000 and room and board, and of course when they came there, it was only room and board, and some of you may have read his comment about it because it was pretty slim board. He said after he'd been in the publishing family for a few weeks, he remarked to a friend that, quote, that he had no objection to eating beans 365 times in succession. Yet when it came to making them a regular diet, he should protest. Pretty slim pickings. He should have come to the cafeteria here. I think he would have been excited about the great variety of food. I mentioned earlier when I was talking about James and Ellen White setting up their first home there, and let me just read the description as Ellen White gives it. This is found in Life Sketches, page 142. We rented an old house for $175 a year. We have a press in the house. Were it not for this, we should have to pay $50 a year for office room. You would smile could you look in upon us and see our furniture. We have bought two old bedsteads for 25 cents each. My husband brought me home six old chairs, no two of them alike, for which he paid $1. And soon he presented me, and that, remember I talked about this earlier, soon he presented me with four more old chairs without any seating, for which he paid 62 cents. Can you see James White presenting these things to his wife? $2.12 was the total of the furniture. Frames were strong, she said. I've been seeding them with drilling. Butter's so high we do not purchase it, neither can we afford potatoes. We use sauce in the place of butter and turnips for potatoes. Our first meals are taken on a fireboard placed upon two empty flour barrels. We are willing to endure privations if the work of God can be advanced. We believe the Lord's hand was in our coming to this place. That's her description of Rochester. Well, Loughborough, who's acquainted with Uriah Smith for 50 years, writes the following account of Rochester. He said, I well remember when the first pamphlet was printed in the Rochester office. The sheets were printed on the hand press. I was talking to somebody last night. It was like a mimeograph machine. It wasn't a printing press. Well, it was a press, but it didn't do more than a mimeograph machine, hardly. That's the way they did it. The sheets were printed on a hand press. A number of believers in Rochester united with the office workers in folding, stitching, covering, and trimming these books. The office had no folding machine, no stitching machine, no paper cutter. As he describes it, he said, after they were stitched with needle and thread, Sister Mary Patton pasted on the covers, and Brother Uriah Smith trimmed the edges with his pocket knife, while Brother and Sister James wrapped them. James White. Brother and Sister James White. I've seen one of those early papers that was trimmed by his penknife. They're rare, but it isn't straight, but the message was straight. Those edges, you know, just with a penknife, but it was a straight message. When they moved to Battle Creek in 1855, Uriah Smith was 23 years old, and 3 years later, the age of 26, he was receiving $5 a week in salary as the chief editor. Now, we talked about the talents of Uriah Smith. He built his own desk. If you were to go to the Review and Herald office today and ask them to see Uriah Smith's writing desk, you would find a very substantial desk. He built it. He was an engraver. Some of the earlier reviews contained engravings that Uriah Smith himself had done, wood engravings, and then these were used for the printing. He was a poet. He was an inventor. When he lost his leg at the age of 12, he found that the artificial limbs of those days were very difficult to use and the foot didn't work well. And so, as a young man, he invented a movable artificial limb and put out a patent on it, or got a patent on it. Of course, he was an editor. He was a writer. He wrote 18 books in his lifetime. He wrote hundreds of articles in the Review. He was a hymn writer, a speaker, a teacher, cabinet maker. Five talented, certainly. Uriah Smith served most of the 50 years beyond his joining them at the age of 21, most of his 50 years as editor of the Review or associate. It can accurately be stated that through his editorials and articles that numbered over 4,000, he was pastor to many people in the Adventist Church. Because you see, the Review was their connection. Many of them were isolated from a place where they could have a pastor of their own, and so the Review became their pastor, and in a sense, Uriah Smith became a pastor to the membership of this church all over the country. A favorite theme of Uriah Smith was heaven, but he contributed perhaps one of his greatest contributions was his study on Daniel and Revelation. And of course, he not only wrote on this subject in the Review, but published the book, Daniel and Revelation, and it's still available today. Talking about heaven, one of the subscribers one day wrote into Uriah and said, will we know each other in heaven? Good question. This subscriber added the following notation after he asked this question: per order of wife. Now, I don't know what his wife said, but she wanted to know if she had to know her husband in heaven, maybe. I don't know. Maybe they weren't getting along. Who knows? But that was the order of his wife. I want to know if we'll know each other in heaven. And Uriah Smith replied with a twinkle in his eye, I think, we're a little at a loss to understand just what condition of things this indicates. If these parties want to know each other in heaven and both get there, we apprehend that there will be no difficulty whatever. But if they do not want to know each other there, it's very clear they will never both get there, and hence there'll be no danger. I think that's a pretty good answer, don't you? Well, seriously, you know, if we're planning to get to heaven, we better be getting along with people, whether it's wife or husband or whoever. Is there any Adventist that you know of that you wouldn't like to know in heaven? Well, that's a challenge, isn't it? Some years ago, one of the editors of the Review did some study on Uriah Smith, and he had an article titled "Smiling with Uriah Smith." He tells about the story of the beans 365 times in succession. In 1875, when Uriah Smith was the editor, he wanted everyone to have a subscription to the Review. And in an appeal to reach a goal for subscriptions, he told how the publishing house received subscriptions to numerous religious journals by sending a single review subscription in exchange. That was very common. Now he wished to make a similar exchange with his readers, asking of them only one paper in exchange for the review. He said, now isn't this liberal? I only want you to send us one paper for a subscription for a year. 52 numbers in return for a copy of one paper. Not a large paper, he said. Only 3 by 6 inches. One sheet printed on both sides. Everyone has them. They're green. You've caught ahead. You're ahead of me, aren't you? And contain but little reading matter on them. It consists chiefly of a promise on the part of the United States of America to pay the bearer $2. They're nice little papers, and we prize them so highly that it matters not if they are all read precisely alike. In this case, we're willing to see the same matter over and over again. If readers did not care to send in so many single papers, they're invited to mail but one in the form of a postal money order for $5 to $50, or a bank draft for $5 to $100. So send in your paper, he said. The pastor and editor, Uriah Smith, felt that it was a responsibility that he had to warn his flock, his readers, about various forms of fraud. In a health reformer piece, he told of receiving from a gift distributing house in Boston an offer of a set of silver spoons, value $10, and a silver watch, value $40, accompanied by 2 certificates. Now, the proposition was this, he said, if you return the 2 certificates plus $2 for each item and 35 cents postage, you would receive the spoons and the watch. So, putting that together, $4 plus postage, $4.35. He wrote to them this way, and he tells about it in his editorial, or in his article. Gentlemen, I received the enclosed certificates from your firm a few days since. I have no wish to take from you $50 worth of property, making you return a return of only $4. It will certainly be better for you, as appears on the face of these certificates, for me to surrender them both, call for the spoons without any remittance, than to send the $4 and claim the watch and spoons. I therefore, instead of sending $2.35 for the spoons, surrender my certificates for the $40 watch, which certainly will cover it, and would like to have you send me the spoons. He says, my reasoning is this, it's certainly good. If your establishment is not one of those bogus concerns with which the country is at present time especially afflicted, and in comparison with which the cholera is a blessing, I shall get the spoons. Respectfully yours, U. Smith. P.S. Don't forget to send the spoons. Well, the warning concluded with this report, and now after manifesting toward them such disinterested generosity and patiently waiting for a long time, we have received no spoons. Could ingratitude go further? If others receive similar certificates from such houses, which we know are sending them out all over the country, let them take warning and beware, or they cannot depend on receiving the spoons. Religious fraud took the form of false prophets. Elder Smith, at another time, received a letter from a Reverend J.W. Medlin, who claimed to be the predicted prophet Elijah. I'm reading from this article that was written by one of the editors. The prophet offered to come to Battle Creek from Tennessee to preach for the Adventists for a year if they would pay his fare and support his family. Commented Smith, this we believe is little of the coolest proposition we've ever received. He noted that there were so many spurious Elijahs in the land that they were quarreling over their rival claims. It's customary in some places to speak of things which are very numerous as being more than you could shake a stick at, he said. But we feel as though we would like to shake a stick at some of these gentlemen who so calmly assume the imposing name and pretend to be the exalted character of Elijah the prophet. Well, I mentioned these this morning as a reminder to you that these early pioneers, though they looked serious many times, had a sense of humor too. And Uriah Smith certainly had this. Unfortunately, Uriah Smith did not always do all that he should. Those of you who'd made any study of the 1888 General Conference session know that when Jones and Wagner preached righteousness by faith and Ellen White supported their message, Uriah Smith was on the wrong side and found himself publicly questioning not only the preaching of Jones and Wagner, but wondering if Ellen White really was a prophet. Now, Uriah Smith had worked and labored with Ellen White from the very beginning, early, at Rochester. He was well acquainted with her ministry. I'm sure many times he had seen her in vision. He had every evidence to have confidence in her. But when he did not accept at the beginning the full message of righteousness by faith, and Ellen White did, he parted company with her for a time and publicly wondered. It was a terrible burden to Ellen White. In 1890, she wrote to him, "Why your particular case agonizes my soul so continuously, cannot define. Again and again have I seen that blindness was upon you to an alarming degree. I give you up to the hands of Jesus and then think I have not more to say, not another word. And then I find my soul torn with anguish, and I'm weeping and praying with strong crying and tears. Take not thy Holy Spirit from him. Do not say there are some things I do not understand." "Of course there are," she says. "Your mind is clouded, but take one step that you do see, and then you can see another." By the way, that's good counsel to all of us. When Uriah Smith received this letter, it moved him to confession. He writes of the experience, "Elder Smith has fallen on the rock and is broken." She writes of this. "Praise the Lord for this. He has made humble acknowledgments, and the Lord will surely manifest himself to Elder Smith." Now, she continued in her comment about Smith with these words, and I think they're significant in light of what we have looked at. Talking about Smith, she said, "These men who have lifted the cross have a stubborn nature." Ellen White was married to a man that had some of that. "And the miracle-working power of God has taken hold of them, and we are rejoiced. We respect Brother Smith. Our confidence in him is restored. We feel more closely united with him in Jesus." Fortunately, Uriah Smith found his way back. Again, we sometimes think of the rebuke or the correction that Ellen White gave to different ones, and we think of those who drifted away and left. There were the Canrites and the Moses Hulls and the Croziers and others. But Ellen White gave just a strong rebuke and correction to some who stayed. And one of them was Uriah Smith. Uriah Smith worked in this church faithfully for 50 years. We know that at the age of 71, he was on his way walking to the office, still serving in an editorial capacity when he died. A contrast between this brother and sister, Annie and Uriah Smith. One only had less than 3 years of ministry in this church. We were blessed by it. The other had 50 years of ministry. These, in my opinion, were two of the five talented. And God used them too.
This has been another classic sermon from the Archive of American Christian Ministries. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistries.org. There you would discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There is no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.